Welcome to democracyonthemove.org, a podcast tribute to the people and organizations who dare to reimagine our nation and drive it toward its true democratic principles. Content for this episode was recorded on Saturday, January 2nd, 2021. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of this podcast, and thank you for joining us today. Today we talk with Jessica Piper, an American literature teacher, public schools advocate, and a Democratic candidate for House District 1 in Missouri. House District 1 covers the northwestern corner of Missouri, bordering the state of Nebraska on the west and the state of Iowa on the north. It is a largely rural district with an average population of somewhere in the order of 37,000 residents. Jessica will be running as a Democrat in a district that is heavily Republican. In fact, the current Republican representative, an incumbent, ran unopposed in 2020, and in the 2018 election, he defeated the Democratic opponent with nearly 80% of the vote. So, does Jess have an uphill battle? Well, it would seem so. Missouri is a trifecta state, meaning that the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion. Also, Republicans enjoy a supermajority in both the House and the Senate. So it would seem a Democrat would not have much of a chance, especially in the rural areas. But don't be too quick to dismiss Jess Piper. She's not some suburban transplant into the rural areas, and she's not your typical liberal. She was raised as a conservative and attended fundamentalist Baptist churches across Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas. So why is she not a conservative Republican? Well, we'll get to that shortly, but suffice it to say for now that Jess is motivated by a deep respect for truth, and she advocates heavily for the process of critical thinking, something she teaches to her high school students and consequently something that doesn't necessarily resonate so well with the majority of the community. Perhaps Jess's most valuable asset is her deep compassion for her community coupled with unparalleled determination and drive. Democracy on the Move would like to emphasize that the views Jessica Piper expresses are hers, based on her experiences, and not that of any entity or organization with which she may be affiliated. Jessica, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us today and being our first guest of a promising new year.
Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, well, I have a big question for you, and I alluded to this in the introduction. You've been raised in the mold of the fundamentalist Baptist church in the South. Your family of origin is highly conservative. Most people raised in this environment would be indoctrinated into the modern conservative mindset. And yet, here you are, an activist for progressive causes. There's actually a photo of you online standing in the town square in Maryville, Missouri, holding a Black Lives Matter sign. Now, I totally admire your activism, but it must feel a bit like you're swimming upstream. What drives you so passionately to fight for progressive causes in rural America?
I think just like you said, because of the way I was born and raised, not only was I born and raised into a fundamentalist Southern Baptist church, but we were poor folks and struggled. And when my dad was in Mississippi, we often didn't have food until he got home in the evening. So my sister and I were hungry often unless we were in school, but summers were a tough time. And so I think my politics and my views come from the fact that I needed help. I relied on my public education to get where I am today. I relied on public services when we could get them. And without them, I can't imagine what would have happened to me.
So you became a teacher. You drove yourself in, and you're now a teacher in rural America. You've lived in rural America your whole life, it sounds like. So, and now you're teaching high school American literature. And this can be a difficult subject because much of the literature being taught is fairly, well, shall we say, open about controversial subjects. But there's a narrative in rural America that doesn't, at this moment, doesn't necessarily line up with the openness of American literature. Now, it's not like you're trying to teach Uncle Tom's Cabin in pre-Civil War Alabama, but openness can nevertheless be seen as a threat to people that are strongly set in their ways. So as a high school teacher in a largely rural setting, how do you deal with this tension? And most of all, secondly, how do your students deal with it?
Well, first I have to say that there's a difference between online, you know, social justice, Jessica Piper, and in class teaching 11th graders, Jessica Piper. Mm-hmm. One thing, I teach the truth, and it's hard to deny what's truth and what's not. I mean, people can take a spin on it, but I teach the absolute truth, and I teach the words of our founders. So when I talk about Thomas Jefferson, and I show the kids, you know, notes from on Virginia, and I show them the Declaration of Independence, we can really get to the heart of the matter. He said, you know, all people were created equally. Did he mean it, guys? And I don't force an opinion down them. I just give them the literature and let them decide what they think. The same way with Abraham Lincoln. You know, I give them the Gettysburg Address and we read that. And then when we read the Emancipation Proclamation. And then I also give them pieces from Abraham Lincoln's past where, you know, he was not an abolitionist and he said that. He thought maybe Black people should be sent back to Africa rather than trying to assimilate with white folks in the United States. And so it's not even pushing anything. It's just giving kids information and letting them make their decisions based on facts.
Well, it's been said truth will set you free, right? And so I think, you know, personally, when I learn about the figures in history like Jefferson and Lincoln, and as you mentioned, and many more, obviously, I get a deeper respect for what our country has been through. Yes, there's a lot of warts on it, but I think that teaching the truth has a value to it, and it says that here's where we were, here's what we did in the past, and here's where we should go in the future. And it would make us better, I would think, for learning these topics and learning all the truth about these topics.
It does, and kids are always really... they're excited to learn something that they didn't know. When we study the founders, I always include what they lived in. I give them a virtual tour of their home and I show them the difference between Washington's Mount Vernon and Monticello and show them the difference in the people who created this country. I always make sure to tell them that, you know, Washington enslaved over 300 people. He manumitted his slaves upon his death. Jefferson, you know, enslaved 600 people. He had children by an enslaved woman. And so all these things are so interesting to kids and they don't walk away going, you know, I hate Jefferson. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. It's that they realize when you put people on pedestals, they're liable to fall off. And so you have to understand, even our framers were humans. Kids really enjoy that, and I think it helps them. It's not some weird foreign document when you take it apart and you intimately know the person who wrote it. I think it creates kids who want to do better and who want to know more about our country.
Yeah. It's interesting that we use the term gerrymandering these days quite a bit, and I'm into words, right? So gerrymandering was actually a combination of Elbridge Gerry and salamander, and it's an interesting origin to that word. But these are the types of things, and that's kind of a trivial thing, obviously, but when you talk about gerrymandering, you have to, I think, look at the word origin and figure out, you know, where it came from and what was behind it, what was happening at the time, and the solutions that were found at that time may have worked for that day, but maybe they don't work. People talk about the Electoral College these days. I've been doing the deep dive on that recently and trying to figure out, you know, why would we come up with such a crazy system? And we've actually had some podcasts on that, but yeah, go ahead.
And you always, and not to sound trite, but I mean, you always come back and you go, oh, it's slavery again. Yeah. Oh my gosh, this is because of slavery again. And so I do teach the history of slavery within my literature course. And I also travel the country and I teach other teachers how to do that. And the reason I do that is one, because I'm really interested in it. I had my first African-American history in Arkansas in my first, in my bachelor's degree. And it was actually taught by a white guy. I never had a Black instructor until I was in my master's program. But I was so interested in it because it talked about our history, our Southern history, and what had happened. And I'd never heard it before, and I didn't know it, and I hadn't read any Black authors, and I just didn't know what I didn't know.
Yeah.
And when I started studying it, I was like, this is, everything would just make sense if we could, if we could have went back and reconstruct in Reconstruction and given everybody the 40 acres and the mule that we promised. Yeah. I just think it wouldn't have been perfect, but my gosh, how things would have been different if we would have done and followed through with those things. And that's why I teach literature, but I teach it in a historical fashion, because it's so interesting to see us keep coming back to the same questions and keep coming back to the same topics and not getting to the point where we really fix it. Yeah. We just talk about it and we keep saying the same things and we just keep moving.
Yeah. Well, I think having this historical context helps you move into the future. And it's been said, and I don't want to like belabor this again, but those who don't know history are destined to repeat it, right? So, sure. And literature is very much tied into history because literature is a result of current events, typically, that are taking place. And so the two are very much tied together. Moving a little bit more into an area that, before we talked today, before we started this podcast, you and I talked a little bit about charter schools. And from what I understand, it's not really an issue directly for your constituents in the northwest corner of Missouri there. But charter schools are at this point trying to proliferate throughout the state. And, some of the statistics I brought up was that here in the St. Louis area where I live, they've had something like 30 plus charter schools that have opened since 2000, but nearly half of them have shut down for academic or financial failure. Yet the charter school solution is being heavily lobbied in our state capital. So do you have any opinions on this, being an educator yourself?
I do. As you alluded to, up here, it doesn't affect us because there are no charter schools within a driving distance. There are a couple of K through 8 private schools here, but nothing within about 20 miles of me. So talking about charters and private schools in rural America is just, it's just not relevant at all. Mm-hmm. The thing that is really bothersome to me is that oftentimes we see them using public funds to go and put money into private hands. Mm-hmm. And I think the public funds should stay in public schools. That's bothersome. I'm afraid sometimes people are making money off children, off private, the privatization of our schools. And this pandemic seems to really have hyped this even more. It's become like this opportunity for privatization. Mm-hmm. And a statistic from the Brookings Institution says that 95% or 92% of people in urban areas live within 5 miles of a private school, but only 34% in rural areas have a private option within the same radius. So they're just not relevant to us. But what is relevant to us is school funding. So if you're skimming funding from public coffers, that affects us in rural areas.
No. Okay. So on to another topic here. This is something that's been near and dear to my heart. I had the opportunity to learn about this recently. Concentrated animal feeding operations, known as CAFOs, C-A-F-O, CAFOs, they've been popping up all over the Midwest over the past several decades. And the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, regulation of these CAFOs seems to be weak at best. And, these operations produce several times the waste product by volume than do people. But the discharge of this waste does not require any processing. So much of it is just simply dumped into the ground near residential areas. They can go within 50 feet of residential areas, from what I understand. Much of it seeps into local streams and wells, presenting a health threat, and the threat is not only bacterial in nature, but the animals in these CAFOs are fed antibodies and hormones, which will also find its way into our water supply. So recently, local communities and counties themselves, and in your area as well, are completely powerless to regulate these operations due to a recently passed Senate bill, Bill number 391. So, and it was pushed by Republicans. And so while Republicans, they speak a lot about local control over local destiny, in this case, they seem perfectly okay with the state exerting direct, heavy-handed control over local communities. So can you kind of walk us through the situation and how it affects your district?
Yeah, I am a subsistence farmer. My husband and I and our children live on 5 acres. We live in an old farmhouse right on the Iowa line. We raise, currently we have 3 cows and we have a sheep, and then we have our own chickens and raise a large garden. Everything about the way we live has to do with the environment. We couldn't do what we do if there were a CAFO located close to me. And the reason is because there's one proposed in Livingston County, which is a few counties over up here in North Missouri. And that county passed ordinances, by health ordinances, saying we don't allow CAFOs here. But SB 391 overturned that. And so now they're looking at a huge hog operation coming in with over 10,000 hogs. They estimate that they'll produce 22,000 gallons of waste every day. And so obviously this waste has to go somewhere. So they say, well, we'll spread it on the fields. I don't know if you have ever been around a field that has been spread with hog manure and a regular
amount. It smells really good, huh?
Yeah, on a summer day, it'll knock you down. Yeah. But living next to one of these absolutely is debilitating. You can't go outside in the summer. The air is not breathable. It seeps into our water. The one in Livingston County is actually going to be located very close to a water reservoir. And it's so frustrating to see. And my representative, who you were talking about at the beginning, who won by 80%, he voted against his own constituents. He voted party line and to allow CAFOs to come into our community. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating because that's not, when people think of farmers, they think of these, you know, people like me or people with 100 acres, that sort of thing. That's not who these people are. They're big ag and they're getting money. And they're running and steamrolling all over rural America. Iowa has just been stomped by big ag. And now they see Missouri as a prime target. And if we don't stop it, if we don't have local control, if we don't have the ability to say, you are not coming into this community unless the community wants it, then what happened in Iowa is going to happen here.
No. I think there's something like 10,000 of these farms up in Iowa, isn't it? 10,000 CAFOs, something of that.
That's what I read. Yeah. And so they're looking for, you know, they're looking for fertile ground, and Missouri looks pretty good to them.
Yeah. I know the Sierra Club fought it, but it was just lobbied heavily by the CAFOs, and some of these CAFOs are owned by foreign interests. So it's kind of a double sting right there as well.
It's really frustrating because we have people that are it's sort of like the Trump effect, where he would appoint somebody to be over a department who was actually there to dismantle the program. And that's kind of what happened here in Missouri. The person who introduced the bill was also over the Department of Agriculture. And so you see that a lot, like the Betsy DeVos, who is anti-school, being over, you know, the public education department.
Yeah. Yeah, she's big into charter schools. The whole DeVos family is behind that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember we talked to Erica Hoffman, who ran for the 96th district in Missouri, and she's the one that actually told me about these CAFOs. And ever since then, I've been diving into this, and it's just I'm floored by the fact that you can have a state government come in and essentially render the local county health department toothless in this area. Uh-huh. And so they can now dump their manure within 50 feet of a residential property, from what I understand, or 300 feet from a water well, I believe.
Exactly. And I mean, I would invite anybody who thinks that this is good for Missouri. And there are people who say that this is bringing money into Missouri. Well, one, it's bringing money into corporate hands, not into family right. farmers. And two, I would invite you to visit one. Visit one. These animals don't go outside. And trust me, I'm not, you know, not a pita person. I eat meat. I grow my own hamburgers. But here's the thing. My animals live outside. They're hand fed. They live, an animal life. These animals are not like that. They're often in these huge barns with no access to sunlight, no access to outside water. They're not nice places. And then just the absolute smell, you just can't imagine it unless you've been around one.
Yeah. Well, I'm a vegetarian and not for that reason specifically, but there is an environmental impact to these CAFO operations, as you mentioned. More and more land is being cleared for them, and the hunger for animal products in the world continues to go up. So they start clearing out rainforests in the Amazon for these operations.
It also depresses the prices of meat that family farmers produce. When you can't compete against someone who has 10,000 hogs in a barn and you've got 50 in your lot. It doesn't help family farms. It doesn't help the people that they think it's helping. Rural people are hurt by CAFOs.
Yeah. Well, I think the family farm is kind of becoming slowly fading into mythology nowadays, isn't it? I mean, it's all going industrialized at this point.
It is. You're exactly right. What people think farming is and what it actually is are just separate things. I mean, you can look into Wisconsin and look at all the family dairy farms that have, completely shuttered. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. So let's shift on to some more national matters. CAFOs are statewide. Well, it's a kind of a national matter too, but it's statewide in the fact that they're penetrating into Missouri at this point. But let's talk about COVID for just a moment, because we've had now over 250,000 people in our country so far have perished from this pandemic. And I believe it's safe to say that our government really has failed to contain it. I'm sure mask mandates have helped mitigate it somewhat. In fact, I know mask mandates have helped to mitigate it. But overall, I'm afraid historians are going to look back on our haphazard response as a abject failure. So in your opinion, what went wrong and what did we do right and what went wrong?
I think what went wrong was just misleading the American public on the dangers of the virus. We saw this from the beginning. They downplayed it. I'm really frustrated because at the end of February last year, I flew to California. I went to LA to study with a program out there, and I came back very sick. And I don't know if I had COVID or when I got, but just the fact that I was traveling at a time when it was dangerous to be in Los Angeles, and nobody told me that. In my own community, I see we do have a mask mandate in Maryville, and I'm so thankful for that. But I'll tell you what, they have had to fight. They've had to fight people who don't want to wear a piece of cloth over their face. And it's frustrating, because what's really frustrating is this weird dichotomy. When I know someone personally who is a good person, who will look out for others in their community, at the same time, unwilling to wear a mask. And it's just, it's strange. And I know it's because they're getting poor information. We didn't do a good job with telling people what to do. And we still see that. And now I think it's just a disaster with the rollout of the vaccine. I would love to have a vaccine. I would love to go. I have 100 kids waiting for me when I come back on January 4th. And they don't know where I've been, and I don't know where they've been. And we do have to wear masks. But other than that, I mean, I have classes with 22, 24 kids, for 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'd really like to have a vaccine. I don't see it in my future for a long time.
Well, I think that, it's the rollout has been flawed. Wouldn't you, as a school teacher, be toward the top of the list? I mean, you know, I know it's not going to roll out for you, I guess, for a few months, but I would think that you'd be one of the earlier ones because of your position and having to deal with all the students.
They say we're in one of the first groups, but just with how slow I see it happening and how few people in my community have had the vaccine, mm-hmm. I don't imagine that I'll get it this school year. I would love to have it before May, but I'm fearful that I won't. And things aren't better. They're just as bad or worse as when they, on March 13th, when the world stopped and we decided we weren't going to continue going to school. Well, now it's, you know, tenfold worse.
Yeah. Wow. So I think, you know, part of the problem with COVID and the information is the nature of information itself. Obviously, there's this thing we have to fight with, well, not fight necessarily, but something that all Americans need to be aware of is the fact that scientific process is a trial and error thing. So I think initially there was not the appreciation that COVID really was airborne. I think people were still thinking it was all by touching surfaces and so on. So, you know, I can see why in the beginning that the message got a little jumbled, but I think it was pretty clear after March timeframe that this thing was airborne and we needed to protect ourselves a little bit more. But I think
exactly
what could have interfered with it more, though, is the partisanship. You know, it became a partisan issue. And in partisanship itself is very much alive in this country. And as a nation, we have sorted ourselves into two warring camps with a whole lot of people in between that are disillusioned with the whole thing but feel rightfully powerless to do anything about it. And it's no secret that the Republicans, by crafting messages that resonate with certain groups of people, have essentially claimed rural America as their territory. And the Democrats have retreated to the cities, and both of them fight for the suburbs. And with each passing, you know, political contest, the partisanship just seems to be getting worse and worse. And some people are starting to call it a cold civil war. So how is that playing out in your district? And what sort of counter messaging do you plan to bring to your campaign for state representative?
For me, I just feel like I need to be able to speak to people. If they can hear me, they realize, oh, well, everything she said makes complete sense.
Mm-hmm.
The message is one of being progressive, of no right to work, that people should be able to unionize. People should be able to, if they work a full-time job, they should be able to live on that. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the Republicans are against that. They right. don't think that working at Walmart full-time should net you an apartment. I do. I think that it should. I think that everyone has a right to health care. I don't think my dad died. He was a Navy veteran. He died 3 years ago now because of a lack of care. And it's just, it's maddening to know that he just needed to be transferred to a different hospital and he would have lived. But his insurance wouldn't allow it and he died. And I don't think that's okay. I think that we should all have access to health care. I think we should be able to visit a dentist. I think that people should be able to afford a pair of glasses. You know, and I think that these things aren't crazy left-wing ideas. They're ideas that rural people get behind. And I know this because rural people vote for progressive ballot measures. They vote against right to work. They vote against gerrymandering. But then we also tend to vote for people who we perceive as having our same morals, and sometimes that's a Republican.
Yeah.
And so that's a struggle, and it's hard for me, and it's hard for everyone in rural America to hear people thinking that we're just dumb hicks who vote against our own self-interest. Mm-hmm. And it's not that. It's this moral. It's this moral. And a lot of times it comes down to a few things. Abortion is very touchy out here, but I approach that by, it's privacy. There's no place in a doctor's office for a state legislator. It's between a woman and her doctor. But the silly things that you hear, like the, you know, I don't know, the late term abortions or abortion on demand, all those things are just, they're not true. They're not real. And so getting that point across is difficult. But just like when I was talking about teaching literature, it's just the truth. I'm just giving you the truth. You just have to trust me. And I think that we want better for our kids. And for that to happen, we have to fund public schools. For out here in rural Missouri, it's a little difficult with keeping our teachers. Because one, and I've taught in a very rural school in Maryville, we're considered rural, but I only teach one course. But I've taught in other schools where I was teaching six. Well, I'm not an expert in six areas. That's difficult. Plus the pay. Plus they also needed me to be the junior high cheer coach. Plus they also needed me to, you know, work admissions. And so what we do to rural teachers creates this system where they leave. And we see the same thing happening with rural administrators. Someone will be elevated to principal, they'll work for 2 years, they are gone. They'll be elevated to superintendent, they work 2 years, they're gone. And so in rural schools, we see a constant, you know, just changing of the guards. But the funny thing is, in rural America, is that our schools are what we're most proud of, you know. We're super excited to show everybody where our kids go and the football team and all the trophies that, you know, the soccer team won. We're proud of them. We just have to support them. And so it's a message that I really hope to get out, and hopefully if people can hear me and if I'm able to post-COVID go and talk to groups of people, they'll understand. I am a Democrat, but my gosh, we fall in line with almost everything.
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the challenges that Republicans have, and they seem to have met this challenge, is how do you push a plutocratic sort of policy onto a general voter electorate? And you mentioned before, you know, people think that country hicks are always voting against their own interests. Well, that may be true from an economic perspective, as you've pointed out. But trying to support this plutocracy, which is what the Republicans have aligned themselves with, the plutocracy being the people that basically have a lot of money and think they own the country. How do they stay in power when the vote belongs to the general electorate? And this is a dilemma that was pointed out in this book. I talked about it last week in the podcast. It was called Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality. And they point out this thing called the conservative dilemma, where how do you support plutocracy with a general voter electorate? And I think you hit the nail on the head. It's generally against people's best interest to best economic interest to vote with the Republicans, but it lines up with their moral imperative.
Exactly. And it's just that we need to get the message out that I'm a Democrat. I'm also a moral human. I may not go to the same church as you do, but I believe that everyone has inalienable rights. I think that, you know, we should work as a community. And that's the difference too between when you actually talk to somebody and you realize that you're really on the same page. And I'm not sure how people can square Donald Trump's, you know, golden toilets with folks out here. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense, but it's a message that they were able to get across. And I'm trying to fight it. Yeah. And doing the best I can, it's just that we have to be able to talk to people. And the partisanship is really tough because a lot of times people will just see that D and they're not going anywhere with a candidate who has a Democrat behind their name.
Yeah. Well, they've been vilified successfully by the Republican Party, and that's not impossible, but I think it is a very difficult very difficult stigma to dig yourself out from.
I had a student last semester who I really enjoy, who I assume is very conservative. And he said, "You are the nicest socialist I ever met." And I said, "Well, one, I'm not a socialist, but two, like you understand that I'm a person, and that when you get to know me, you realize that I have your best interests at heart. And a lot of times I don't hate Republicans, but I don't see a lot of them having people like me and my interests at heart, or my children. And that's really what sort of pushed me to do what I'm doing. Because what I'm doing right now is not comfortable. Running for office in a small town as a Democrat in Missouri is not comfortable. It's not a nice place to be in a lot of times, because people make assumptions about me. Sometimes I'm worried about, you know, my job. Mm-hmm. It's tough, but it just felt like it's enough. It's enough. You guys are harming people that I know. You're doing things sometimes out of spite. When I see them writing bills against the LGBTQ community, I look at those students that I have in my classroom and my heart is broken for them, because they're people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why you're going after them. And so things like that, just after a while, motivate you to think, I have to do something, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's again, part of the equation is that when you create a partisanship environment, you have to sort people into different camps. Abortion, for example, was never an issue until the late 80s, early 90s, when the conservatives, the Republican Party, started to make it an issue. Go right down the line, family values, flag burning, and so on. This is just a way of sorting people out. And so if you can grab that moral mantle with people, they will vote in their best interest from a moral perspective before they vote in their best interest for an economic perspective. And yeah, and painting you with a brush of socialism, I'd have to ask the average person, what is socialism, right? What is the definition of socialism? And the textbook definition is where the state owns the means and distribution of, or means of production and its distribution. So that is very far away from the system that we have today, and I don't think it's fair to paint anybody with that brush.
I don't either. I believe in the public. I believe in the public good. And so to paint Democrats who are like me as socialists is just outlandish. But the right has been really smart in their messaging and giving people a couple of phrases, a couple of words. And it's frustrating to see people thinking that Colin Kaepernick is, a horrible human being, but at the same time looking at Josh Hawley, who is trying to, who is being a traitor. He's committing sedition, and they think that's okay. And so it's where those critical thinking skills come into play. You have to think, someone who kneeled for the anthem probably shouldn't be in the same category with someone who can literally, quite literally, overthrow our democracy. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to get people to think sometimes really critically about those things, especially when they're just drowning in the media that some of them are drowning in. And I know it well, because my dad, before he passed away, was absolutely immersed in right wing. Well, he started like a gateway drug. He started with Rush went into Fox News, and then he went even deeper into things like the Daily, is it Caller? I think Daily Caller and things like that, to where I couldn't even really speak to him anymore. I didn't understand what he was saying. I didn't know where the information was coming from. I just knew that it wasn't factual, but I couldn't combat it. And so, it's happened to several of my family members. And it's 2016, just really, it hurt a lot of people. It really did.
Yeah. And I think the bottom line too is the economy, right? Or the economic decisions people are making. And we highlighted the CAFOs as an example of something that people are supporting inadvertently by supporting what they think are their morally right thing to do. And then on the backside, you've got now a CAFO next door to you. And so these are the same people you voted for to protect your moral interests, and now your economic interests are just being totally thrown away. So,
right. And I see people that are arguing against a higher minimum wage for others when they're just barely above the minimum wage. And it's like, you guys shouldn't be arguing against each other. The problem is the top is squeezing us and pushing us down. It's not each other. It's not us out here. It's what they're doing when they get to Jeff City. And just like with the yes on three, no on three, all they had to do was make yes on three a Republican issue. And there were signs all over town for yes on three. Mm-hmm. But do you know what that means? Do you know what they're doing? No, but all they had to do was make it a Republican issue and you've got the signs up.
Yeah.
So Democrats, I mean, we really do need to work on better messaging. I know a lot of people, I've heard, people call Democrats elites, but I think they're probably not talking about, I know they're not talking about people like me. They could come out to my farm and tell me I'm an elite and right. That won't fly. But it's the messaging and the GOP. I do have a pretty big Twitter following, and the GOP caught wind of me running, and they quote tweeted me and said that I'll never be elected to the first district because I'm too extreme. Hmm. The tweet they quoted was me asking to fund public schools in my area.
Yeah. Well, that's
and
extremist.
So that, I don't know how disconnected you can be with my district to tell me, a public school teacher, that asking for funding for my students is extreme.
No.
But they say the words. They just say the words. And sometimes people just listen. So that's the thing. We have to talk to people in rural America. And I know a lot of people want to discount us because it's like, well, we're tired of listening to you guys, and you guys, you know, have a lot of pull, even though you're not really the majority. But here's the thing. We can't do big things in Missouri if we don't have rural Missouri. And the only way to get us is to have boots on the ground, to have people out here, to have grassroots organizations, to go around and talk to people and say, we aren't what they said we are. Mm-hmm. I live next to you. This is who I am.
That's going to be a bit of an uphill battle, I think. But I also think that when crazy town starts to visit us, and you get these crazy half-loaded sort of conspiracy theories out there, it gets to the point where I think only the most extremist person would start to believe in all these things, whereas most people, as you know, would have some sense of reasonableness about their lives, that maybe they would, you know, eventually somehow see, hey, there's something wrong with this equation here. There's something that isn't jiving with reality.
Exactly.
So, well, you know, Joe Biden will be our next president come January 20th, despite the best efforts of Josh Hawley, as you mentioned. Also, Sam Graves, the U.S. congressperson for your district there, supported Josh Hawley, too, which is quite depressing, actually. But anyways, there will be, when January 20th comes by and Biden becomes president, there's going to be a temptation to breathe a sigh of relief. Yet the conditions, as we're talking about now, the conditions that gave rise to this extreme partisanship remain. And I think what's making matters worse now, as I alluded to also, that the Republican Party seems destined to tear itself into classic conservatives, assuming there's any remaining, and for the lack of a better term, Trumplicans. But the Democratic Party also has to deal with an extreme progressive wing that is demanding concessions from the Biden administration. And I'm not sure the Biden administration is going to be that cooperative with it. So when you look into the crystal ball, what do you see happening over the next 2 years that'll provide opportunities for your candidacy?
I'm a little fearful. One, one thing, nothing really changes in Missouri so much. I mean, it's a little less frustrating to have someone that's constantly tweeting crazy things, mm-hmm. or, you know, is hateful. But as far as Missouri goes, we're still under a supermajority. I still have the same rights that I had, you know, a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. I'm a little fearful that no matter what Biden does, that will trickle down to Democrats, you know, even down as far as a state rep and district one. And we have to worry about getting somebody to run against Roy Blunt. And then that person will also will be associated with me. And so things like that are worrisome mm-hmm. to me. And I can, you know, I can only do the best I can do. At the beginning of this, when I talked to the state party, they were adamant, you know, you cannot win. You cannot win. This is going to take three cycles, maybe four cycles. But I'm just a crazy person. I'm crazy enough to believe if people hear me, I think I could win. Yeah. I don't know why I can't win. Why can't I win? And so it's frustrating to hear that. That's tough for candidates across the state to hear that. There were over 50 unopposed seats in 2020. Nothing's going to change if people don't get uncomfortable and do what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I hope that other people will. And as far as with Biden, honestly, you know, in Missouri, I don't, other than having to deal with crazy, I don't know what else is going to change immediately mm-hmm. for us. It's frustrating for me to see some of the state representatives in the state. There's one, I think he's from St. Charles, but he went on Facebook the other night and proclaimed that he is not a Republican. He is a Trump Republican, and then, you know, mm-hmm. did his whole thing. And so that to me is jarring and a little scary. Just like you said, I mean, if they're going to break themselves apart, then go for it. Maybe that leaves us some room, but yeah. I'm scared that they, that wing of the party is really strong yeah. in the Republican Party.
Well, the classic Republicans, they are actually, they have been throughout history fairly progressive. Mm-hmm. It's just been recently. I mean, they're obviously Lincoln was a Republican, but you know, going even further, you know, women's suffrage and I mean, just go down the line with unions and so on. They've always been very supportive of progressive issues. It's just the last few decades it's been turned around for some reason, and so maybe what we would see if the Republican Party splits apart into what I said, the Trumplicans versus the conservatives. Maybe that's okay. You know, maybe the conservatives will come back if they can retain the mantle of the Republican Party, or maybe they create a whole new party. I don't know. That could be a reasonable thing. That could be a reasonable development. I'm perhaps being optimistic here, but that's one scenario.
Well, and I mean, I think that to make our country what it can be, we need lots of different voices. We need conservative voices. We need, you know, voices from everywhere. It's so supermajorities to me are very scary. Mm-hmm. And they can, we know that anything can happen in Jeff City without a Democrat even showing up. And so yeah. that to me is scary. I don't think that anyone should have that much power, including my own party. I don't believe that people should be shut out of democracy just because they happen to hold a different view. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, the heart of what has gone wrong in Missouri. My congressman, my senators, my congressman hasn't been to anywhere I've seen him in 5 years. I think he debated somebody before 2016. Hmm. He's not here. He doesn't come here. He doesn't visit here. He doesn't pretend to come here. He doesn't pretend to care. And he's elected in a landslide every time. And so, it's frustrating.
No.
And it makes all of us powerless, not just me as a Democrat, but my neighbor across the street is a Republican, and she's just as powerless as I am because he doesn't care, and he knows that he doesn't have to answer to anybody.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating.
Yeah. That's how represent.us, I don't know if you're aware of that organization. I'm pretty sure you are. Mm-hmm. Their whole battle cry, really, from what I understand, is to say, hey, no matter what people want, they're not getting what they want. The politicians are voting in their own best interest, and you know, to hell with the constituents. They don't really matter so much. What matters is the money that flows in to support the campaign, so they can run again the next time around. So,
right, and we have a lot of people that come in as state reps and immediately start looking at the Senate, and it's just like, can you work on the job that you have right now? Can you please just do the job that you have right now, and then maybe we'll talk? But it's, you know, yeah. Josh Hawley ladder climbing syndrome. They get in, they promise they're going to stay, they're gone.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you can see it with a lot of the pre-file bills that I've been looking through. The people, honestly, there's several people in Jefferson City that don't even know what they're proposing. There's one that I've talked at length about, and it's a bill for patriotic education. And I know what they're getting at. They're upset about the 1619 Project, and they don't want people talking about slavery or Black Lives Matter or Marxism, whatever they think we're doing. And by the way, there's another word. Define Marxism for me before you call me one. the patriotic education is really frustrating for this reason. It's a duplicate of what is already in Missouri state standards in elementary, in middle school, in high school, in government, in American lit, in American history. And they're spending all this money to create a commission to say that we should teach the things that, guys, we already teach.
We're already teaching, right.
And it's such a waste of money, thousands of dollars. And it's not the only bill that is asking teachers to teach things we already teach. Yeah. But they don't know that because either they don't spend the time or they don't reach out to experts. And that's something that I think that someone like me understands. I'm not an expert in everything. I have an advisory board who helps me. I don't understand rural healthcare like I should. So I have a registered nurse who works at Mosaic who can tell me what is happening. I don't understand higher education like I should. So I have a professor from the university who could tell me. Because I need advice. I need people who know more than me. And I'm afraid that's kind of what's lacking down there, is that they're just going with whims or whatever they think and not looking for experts.
Well, the term patriotic education paints a picture in my mind, too, that, you know, it's the America first. It's the, you know, make America great again sort of education that completely underplays, if not completely ignores, all the horrible things in the past, and just focuses on the good things.
Right. It's all Revolutionary War is what they asked to be taught over and over again. You know, teaching the mission of the Constitution, and it's really hard to teach the Constitution without saying, you know, it upheld slavery, but they want you to leave that part out.
Yeah.
They just want you. I'm not sure what they want actually, but the silly part is it's already done anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, just incidentally, that happens in a lot of countries. I quite a few years ago now, was in Japan, and I was working for a couple of weeks with some of the engineers there. I'm an engineer, and this was during the Rodney King riots in L.A., and I was living in L.A. at that time. And some of the guys in Japan asked me, they said, hey, how come you guys have such issues with race, and how come this is such a big issue? And I had to kind of like hold back because I didn't want to talk about what, you know, I didn't want to really tell the truth and say, what did you guys do during World War II? What did you guys do to China?
Right.
How do you treat Koreans these days? You know, it's the same thing, guys. You know, you're not getting the right education here. So I bit my tongue, though.
It's easy to point fingers at other people, you know, but I think until we all, I've been teaching this a long time. And when I teach this, I inevitably will have kids and that'll say, well, how's this my fault? You know, how's slavery my fault? Well, honey, it's not your fault, but neither is global warming, but you have to deal with it.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You didn't create the problem, but guess who has to fix it?
Right.
You. So we have to know where all this stems from. And then we're able to at least make some strides towards fixing it.
Mm-hmm. Well put. Well, you know, we're kind of coming up to the end right here. I'd just like to, I could talk to you for hours, but I think we have to wrap it up here. What can, now that you're running for your Missouri District 1, and that'll be the year 2022, so you're getting a good start on this, what can people do now to help your candidacy? And do you have a campaign website, and are you taking donations, and what's going on in that area of your life?
Absolutely. I have a website up. It's I'm using UpBallot. So it's upballot.com/Jessica Piper. I'm also accepting donations through there. I would appreciate any form of a donation. This is going to be a really big uphill battle. And I can get in front of people and I can talk to people, but I'm also going to need mailers. I'm going to need signs. I'm going to need things to get across to people that you know, I am a candidate here, I am viable. So it's upballot.com slash Jessica Piper, and there's a link there. But also in the next few months, especially when we get to 2022, I'm going to really need some people to help me knock doors and that sort of thing. So getting any volunteers going is also something that I would be interested in.
Okay. Yeah, I've done some door knocking myself in the past, and they always gave me these list of people to see, and they said, you ought to be able to walk this in a couple hours. Like, no, I finally just wised up. And some of these areas are kind of rural that I was going to also, so I just brought my bike with me because it's
It's well, the worst part usually I've noticed with knocking on doors is not the people, but their dogs.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true.
But that's about it.
Yeah, now I know how a mailman feels.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's UpBallot. What was the name of the website again?
It's upballot.com slash Jessica Piper.
Jessica Piper. J-E-S-S-I-C-A Piper. All one word?
Mm-hmm. There's a hyphen in between there.
Oh, hyphen. Okay, Jessica hyphen Piper. Okay, great.
I do difficult things because they're free.
Yeah, well, that's take it as you can get it.
Exactly.
So anyway, great. So anyways, we've been talking with Jessica Piper, an American literature teacher, a public schools advocate, and a Democratic candidate for House District Number 1 in Missouri. Jess, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Democracy on the Move, a tribute to all those people and organizations who dare to reimagine our nation and drive it back to its true democratic principles. Please tune in each week where we will feature guests and topics that will keep you in touch with our march toward a more perfect union. If you have any suggestions for stories and or people you think we should cover at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through our website contact page at democracyonthemove.org/contact or send us an email at info@democracyonthemove.org. You can also comment on our Twitter page at All on the Move, or you can comment on our Facebook page at Democracy on the Move. If you find today's podcast interesting and informative, please tell your friends and family about us. And if you would like to help sponsor the podcast at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through the website or email. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of the podcast, and I'd like to thank you for tuning in. It's been my pleasure to be with you today. Please have a safe week ahead, and we hope you'll tune in for our next show.